Hello and welcome to an episode of Canada mit C, or in English, Canada with a C. My name is Annika Weikinnes. I am the project manager of the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung Canada. Today's guest is Dr. Michael Borchert, a celebrated historian, political scientist, and author. This podcast episode delves into the Gaza conflict's international repercussions, historical and contemporary anti-Semitism, and insights from Dr. Borchert's book titled An Impossible Friendship, David Ben-Gurion and Konrad Adenauer. Dr. Borchert studied political science, contemporary history, and public law at the University of Bonn. He is a former member of the team of speechwriters for the former federal chancellor Helmut Kohl and head of the speechwriting division for the former minister president of the state of Thuringia, Bernhard Vogel. From 2003 to 2014, he was the director of the department Politics and Consulting at the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung in Berlin. From 2014 to 2017, Dr. Borchert served as resident representative of the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung in Israel. Dr. Borchert is currently the director of the Department of References and Research Services / Archive for Christian Democratic Policy at the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung and responsible for the documents of the CDU. Thank you very much, Dr. Borchert, for participating in today's episode of Canada mit C. The interview will be conducted by Dr. Norbert Eschborn, director of the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung Canada. Thank you, Norbert. Over to you now.
Dr. Borchert, welcome to our podcast, Canada mit C, Canada with a C. You have come to Canada this week to launch your new book, which is about David Ben-Gurion and Konrad Adenauer and their impossible friendship. But you're not only a distinguished historian, you have been the Konrad Adenauer Foundation's representative to Israel for several years. Have you ever experienced a Middle East conflict which has caused so much turmoil, like the current Gaza war?
Well, I just came to Israel in right in the middle of Operation Protective Edge, which actually was the last big Gaza war. But I have to admit that nothing can be compared to October 7th. Mm. It's a totally different situation. It's the highest death toll on the Israeli side since the Holocaust, but it goes also much deeper than that. Because the idea since the times of Theodor Herzl was to create a safe haven for Jews, where they can live freely, where they can be free of discrimination. And this trauma shatters the firm belief that this safe haven still is intact. We in the world tend to see, tend not to see how much this is changing Israel. And this also explains why a vast majority of Israelis think that the answer to the Hamas terrorist attacks should be very strong. And should be a strong military answer in order to defeat this threat and in order to reinstall this kind of safe haven for the Jews.
So polarization of public opinion is per se not that unusual. However, it seems to be different in this case. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations are taking place all over the world, for example, at universities, both in Germany and here in Canada. And it seems to me, and I think I'm not alone with this, that Israel is losing the battle for the minds. Is that so, and why is that so?
I don't think that it is that black and white mm-hmm. as it might appear. If you take a closer look at Germany and the political parties, you can really see that at least the mainstream parties, of course, excluding the right-wing extremists and the left-wing extremists, there's a broad consensus and a very broad support for Israel. It is only the right-wing and left-wing extremists clearly going in other directions. In a way, October 7th was a mobilization factor. Those who were firmly on the side of Israel were sometimes reluctant to show their support. They are now acting more openly. But of course, the political elite does not resemble the big public. That's very important to say. There is a big role of the media, and the media clearly is biased here. In Germany, and I think this study is rather authentic because it has been made by our colleagues of the Ebert Foundation, in Germany, roughly 75% of the journalists perceive themselves to be rather left-leaning. And if you now look at these people, I grew up with these people. They were on my schoolyard. In the late 70s, in the early 80s, it was somehow chic to be on the left side. And part of that was feeling sympathetic to the cause of the Palestinians. On our schoolyard, it was even en vogue to wear kufir, or as we said back in that time, the Arafat scarf. Now these people are editors-in-chief, they are leading journalists, they are university professors, they are leading artists, they are directors of museums, but their political socialization still is very active. And the other point is Hamas is not only very active in Israel or in Hamastan, in, as we say, for the Gaza Strip, and in the West Bank. Hamas is also very active in Europe. And it took us in Germany a couple of decades, to ban and to forbid Hamas as an organization. This just recently were set in place. I think what is key is the resilience against Hamas narratives, against their propaganda, and this only works if there's knowledge. There is a disturbing amount of superficiality. I might illustrate this with a wonderful joke, again referring to the journalists. There's a German journalist who is in Tel Aviv. He's sitting in a street cafe and just typing in his typewriter, in his laptop. So another German journalist is approaching him and he says, wow, you're in Israel, I didn't know. And what are you doing there? I came yesterday to Israel. Ah, you came yesterday. And what time will you be leaving the country again? I will leave the country tomorrow. Ah, okay. And so what are you doing there? I'm writing a book. So what's the title of the book? The other one answers, well, the title of the book is Israel, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. And actually, it's not a joke. Mm. I mean, this really illustrates how superficial the way is we are going to look at Israel. And I think in this case, encounter is key. Exchange is key. The best way to become immune against Hamas propaganda is actually to visit Israel and to see yourself that this is a vibrant country. And there is a lot to also see under this very heavy curtain of this very heavy carpet of the Middle East conflict.
That's probably a very good recommendation. The armed forces of Israel have normally been considered to be well prepared for any conflict. Now, we have seen in last October that was obviously not the case then. As far as you can judge it, what was the reason for their, I would consider it to be a failure in their job? And how do you evaluate the chances of a peace, both in terms of timeline and in terms of conditions?
First, I have to make a book recommendation. There's a fascinating book which has been written by Ron Leshem, a former officer of the Secret Service. The title of the book is Fire. And this investigative piece of journalism really very clearly shows that the security services did know very well what was going on. There was even, just imagine, there was a TV show which has been produced in the Gaza Strip. They still produce TV shows. And in this TV show, they totally kind of planned this attack. And then this TV show, it got an award, and the award was awarded to them by Shinwa, by the leader of the military, by the Hamas leader. So if you would have been taking a closer look, you could have seen that this was going on. All information was on the table, but it was the elite around the prime minister and also Netanyahu himself, also parts of the leadership of the defense forces who did not draw the right conclusions. There has been a strong belief on their side that a major attack is currently not in the interest of Hamas. And this was totally wrong. Now I think we are in one of these very special moments in history where everything is possible. Either it can go dramatically to the positive side, or it can go dramatically to the other side. First, we have to answer the question, the very famous question, what happens the day after? What I'm talking about is if the IDF succeeds more or less in beating Hamas, at least in the Gaza Strip, then the continuation of the status quo cannot go on. So there will be a totally different situation. The Gaza Strip cannot be occupied by forces. The defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who is, I think, a key figure currently in Israel, said very clearly we can't keep up an occupation in the Gaza Strip. So there will be maybe the chance for a new way of thinking, but there still will be a lot of ifs. We would need a stronger Palestinian authority. We would need a stronger Palestinian leader than Abbas. We would need the support of Arab states and the US. What happens if Donald Trump is in office? We need tons of money. We need, most important, an Israeli government without the right-wing extremists, Ben-Gvir, Bezalel Smotrich, but foremost, without Netanyahu. Hmm. That's tons of ifs. But the situation can also go... So in that case, if all these ifs can be solved, we might have a solution. We might have a situation in which the Gaza Strip maybe can be developed to be a more peaceful a part of that region. Actually, there's enough money. There are gas fields just right in front of the Gaza Strip, and they can be exploited. And this money can also flow to the Gaza Strip. So money is not entirely and not only the problem. But the situation can also go in the opposite direction. Key to that is how Iran is going to react in that region. The escalation in which is currently going on in the north is also very dramatic, and it's totally overseen in the West. There's not enough news about what is going on in the northern part, where a lot of people had to evacuate their homes. Around about 400,000 had to be removed from that region. So what happens if Iran escalates further? What happens, on the other hand, if the Israeli government succumbs somehow to the desire of the public to start a new war in Lebanon in order to fight Hezbollah? It's very unlikely in the moment, but you never know. So there is a potential for escalation, but there's also a potential for maybe some way which might lead, and I'm very cautious here, which might lead to any other kind of situation that we are in just right now.
Okay, from a historical perspective, the Palestine issue is much older than the state of Israel, and to outsiders, which most of us are, seems overly complex. Can you nevertheless please try to briefly explain what are the insurmountable differences that prevent Palestinians and Israelis from living together peacefully?
I think you already said the right word, and that's a good question. The right word is history. And let me illustrate this again with a very deep joke. There's the famous story about a rabbi who is a very, very talented conflict dissolver. And so there's two guys who are in constant fight with each other. They are approaching the rabbi, and the rabbi is sitting there and is asking the first guy to come into his room, and he's starting to talk to him. So he's asking the guy, so what's going on? Why are you so mad at each other? So he says, well, the other guy was supposed to marry my daughter. He didn't do that, and he was just spending my money and so forth and so on. It's really incredible, and I'm in deep conflict with him, and he's totally wrong. So the rabbi looks at him, and he touches his beard, and then he looks at him and he says, "You're right." And the guy goes out of the room and says, "I'm right. The big rabbi, he said to me, I'm right." So the other guy enters the room. And he says, well, that's totally wrong what he's saying. The daughter was very ugly, and I've never spent just a shekel. It's all very made up, and it's the whole story is wrong. And he can't blame me for this or that. the rabbi looks at him and says, well, I think you're right. So the other guy goes out of the room and says, he said, I'm right. I would show the other guy that I'm right. The big rabbi said, I'm right. So the whole story then had been already been brought to the wife of the rabbi. The rabbi is coming home to the wife, and the wife is cooking for him. And then she says, man, you are so mad. What did you do? You said to both of the guys, they are right. And now they are fighting each other even more because they think they are right. So the rabbi is looking at his wife and he says, you are right. And I think this is a totally deep joke, I have to say. To just exchange these narratives, which are really right, the right to exist of Israel, but in the same time, the right to exist and the right of self-determination of the Palestinians in that region, these narratives are right. But the wife of the rabbi is also wise, because it does not at all help just to repeat these narratives over and over. But what is important is to acknowledge these narratives, but in the same time to look for solutions. Israelis are still denied the right to exist, and the widespread slogan, which can also be heard in Canada, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free, is a disturbing sign of for this attitude. But also the right-wing Israelis deny the Palestinians their own identity. There was a famous Knesset session in which Miri Regev, the cultural minister back in that time, then said, there is no such thing as a Palestinian. They just don't exist. It's all made up. They are Arabs. They are Jordanians, whatever. Another factor is, for decades, this conflict was mainly a regional, national, territorial conflict with some, I would say, religious undercurrents. Now it becomes more and more a religious conflict with national and territorial dimensions. The first already seems unsolvable. The latter is unsolvable. Polls of institutions like PEW clearly show that both sides, the Palestinians as well as the Israelis, this has to do on the Israeli side with the growing part of the Mizrahi Jews, are more and more religious. Why is that problematic? Don't get me wrong, the settlements are a severe danger to peace, and I personally strongly condemn them. But they are not the only problem. We shouldn't forget that they are a symptom of the conflict, but it's not the cause of the conflict. Some initiatives like the Geneva Initiative did clearly show that there might be a viable solution in case there would be negotiations on a peace treaty. But we tend to forget that there is one issue which seems absolutely unsolvable. And here comes the religious dimension into the game. It is Jerusalem. Both sides demand that the eternal city cannot be divided. Both demand the city. Hmm. So we need to find a solution for Jerusalem. This is really a big problem which cannot be solved easily. And we tend to forget that this is maybe one of the main issues we would have to tackle.
Right. Historically, Europe has not only been a continent of very rich Jewish life, but in large parts, it has always been a stronghold of anti-Semitism, pogroms, and the Holocaust, not to forget. Why are anti-Jewish prejudices and anti-Semitism so deeply entrenched in many European minds?
I think that is somehow the $1 million Canadian dollar question. To put it rather simple, I think it is not entrenched in European mind. It is entrenched in the human nature. This is what I fear. Throughout the centuries and until the time of Enlightenment, religion, of course, played a role. Judas being the symbol for the traitor, the eternal Jew. I mean, if you look at some paintings of the Last Supper, you can see that all the disciples are being portrayed to, their faces are European faces. There is only one Oriental face on the picture, It's always Judas. Sometimes even with anti-Semitic stereotypes, with a hooked nose, whatever. So you can really see that this, of course, was also a religious question. Now we are confronted with the so-called new anti-Semitism, which is often Israel-related. I think there is no such thing. There is no new anti-Semitism. Somewhat, I think it is somewhat comparable to a hybrid car. So in that case, the new anti-Semitism would be the electrical engine, the electrical power driving the engine. It can drive the engine only for short distances. But in the end, every new anti-Semitism cannot exist without the old anti-Semitism. A new quality is the combination of identity politics and anti-Semitism. The Jew as the white person, Zionism as a colonial project, which is totally unhistoric. Israel is rather a result of decolonization, not of colonization, because the precondition for the founding of the State of Israel was the British leaving the Mandate territory in the Holy Land. Besides that, the Zionist idea never was expansionist. It concentrated on creating the one homeland for the Jews. So this narrative of the colonial Jew, this embodies the old patterns of the Jew being the eternal threat against everybody. So there is no new anti-Semitism. In the end, also the new anti-Semitism is old anti-Semitism.
Similarly, today's anti-Semitism seems to be characterized, what I would call a higher propensity for violence than the forms we already know. Younger people in particular seem to have lower inhibition thresholds. How do you explain this?
I don't know if we can put it that simple, but when it comes to hate and anti-Semitism-related crime, we in Germany thought that this is a phenomenon of right-wing extremists, young generations. Also some taboo-breaking behavior, you know, the skinheads and other people also exerting a certain kind of anti-Semitism. But we also had a statistical problem. Because every incident which could not clearly be related to whatever form of anti-Semitism was summarized in Germany under right-wing extremism. So we had very high rates of right-wing violent attacks on Jews. But some of these even were attacks by Islamists or by leftists. So I think now it is very important to take off this kind of pink eyeglasses and to realize that we have a widespread phenomenon also of left-wing extremism, also among the younger generation, as well as the Islamist kind of extremism. And of course, there we see some lesser inhibition on violence here.
We are also seeing a lot of pro-Palestinian demonstrations here in Canada these days. There are, of course, numerous immigrants from Islamic countries here, always have been. Does being a Muslim always mean being anti-Israeli, anti-Jewish, and anti-Semitic at the same time?
No, absolutely not. I might tell you a little anecdote. One of the projects I did when I was in Israel is I invited young German leaders, so parts of the German elite, to Israel. That doesn't sound very originally. Doesn't sound very witty to do these kind of things. That's just the normal business all of us do. But what I did is I invited Muslims. German young leaders, but all Muslims. And you know what? I couldn't be more proud of my fellow citizens because they were in Israel and they said to the president of the Knesset, to the speaker of the Knesset, I'm German. I decided freely to be a German. So the Shoah is part of my history. Even though it's not in factual terms, It is now because I'm a German. So I have to deal with what happened here. And I was very proud of these guys, I have to admit. So there, among the elite, you will find a lot of Muslims who are clearly, and sometimes even with good ideas, are opposing anti-Semitism. But on the other hand, we can't deny that there is the phenomenon of this also Islamic kind of anti-Semitism. But also there, I would warn to say it's just the immigrants coming after 2015, after this wave of immigrants came into Germany, we had the idea that these all contribute to anti-Semitism. In a certain way, they do. But I think we should have a closer look. It is the second or third generation, which is also kind of problematic in this case. And it's not entirely their fault, one has to say, because they are sitting somehow between the chairs. In Germany, they are being the Turks. When they travel on holidays to Turkey, they are being called the Deutschländer, the Germans. Yeah? And so what they are doing is they are sitting between the chairs. They are looking for their own identity. If they come to the wrong peers, they are in a severe danger of radicalization. Those who celebrated the attacks on Israel on the Sonnenallee in Berlin with baklava, you know, this disturbing scenes in the television, they have not been the first generation immigrants. They have been second, third, even fourth generation immigrants to Germany. And we have to have a closer look at these people. One other thing we have to discuss, though, is maybe how to deal with Islam on an academic level. I'm not naive enough to believe that it is possible to create, so to say, a European kind of Islam, a homemade, tolerant Islam. But we should nonetheless strengthen those scholars who support a discussion of some kind of an enlightened interpretation of the Quran. And its anti-Semitic contents. There is the University of Osnabrück. There are some really good scholars who really say all these lines in the Quran, the Jews are pigs, all these portrays, they have to be seen in the historic context. And I think this work also is very important.
How do you experience anti-Israeli protests in Germany? There have been some terrible incidents. I'm thinking of the smearing of Jewish citizens' letterboxes in Berlin with Jewish stars. And these excesses have been noted with concern around the world. Do you think that Germany is on the brink of a new anti-Semitism? And we thought that was no longer possible. Also in view of the political education that institutions such as both our employer, the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung, has been provided for years.
I have to admit that if you would have asked me 5 years ago, would you imagine that this kind of explosion of anti-Semitism could happen? I would have said no. I can't imagine. Since October 7th, we had an increase of much more than 300% in I'm talking about incidents. I'm not talking about just some anti-Semitic sayings, but I'm really talking about criminal attacks. I think we again need to see that schools are crucial. Surveys like ours from the Adenauer Foundation, but also others, show clearly and really unmistakably that school lessons can make a difference after all. Muslim anti-Semitism decreases significantly with school attendance. You really can see this relation. The more young people attend school, the more they deal with these issues, the lesser they are sensitive to this kind of anti-Semitic temptation. That is why we need to focus on education policy. After October 7th, all curricula in the federal states. You know, in Germany, the federal states are responsible for education must be reviewed, and the topics of Israel and anti-Semitism must be given much more prominence. Teacher training must be taken into account. I think this is still very important. There is a German-Israeli school book commission, which is also looking at these school books. But I think there is tons of things to do. Again, also school exchange is crucial. But education is, in my opinion, education is key. And we have to increase knowledge. We have to increase our efforts to put education here in the first place.
You want Canada to launch your new book, David Ben-Gurion and Konrad Adenauer, An Impossible Friendship. Is what you have been describing in this book like an indicator how to achieve peace by building bridges, overcoming deep rifts between personalities who once were on opposite sides of very, very harsh conflicts? If so, what must be done to achieve this kind of rapprochement?
I think there's two things that we can learn from these two guys. One is, I mean, you have to look at in what times they have been politically active. It was totally dark times. If you look at the situation 45 in Germany, the whole country was destroyed. There was mistrust against the Germans for good reasons. So Adenauer came on the political stage, and he was everything. He was, but he was not a fatalist. He was very skeptic. He thought his fellow citizens might be also might fall to these temptations of radicalization. So he thought they need to have re-education. They need to be looked at very closely. But he was never ever fatalistic. He was always, to a certain extent, realistic but also optimistic. And the same applies to David Ben-Gurion. Also, David Ben-Gurion was the prime minister in times in which the future seemed to be very, very dark. I mean, look at the War of Independence, 48. Israel was a couple of times at the brink of losing its existence. And there he was very, very optimistic again, and never fatalistic. And the other thing, I think, the other attitude that was predominant on both sides is empathy. Not to be cold, to really look at each other, to be interested what's going on, to be interested in what is going on in Israel, but also the other way around. Konrad Adenauer, as well as Ben-Gurion, have been totally well informed about what was going on in Germany back in that time. They had their assistants working with them, so they did know perfectly well what was going on, but always with empathy, with real empathy. I think this is very, very important. Mm-hmm. In Germany, we see also that you have the tendency when it comes to teachers who would say, "I'm not touching this issue. It's too hot for me to handle. Can't deal with it. It's very complicated. I can't get hold of this." I think we can't afford to do this. When it comes to the Shoah on the German side, I think there is no duty not to criticize Israel. I've been in Israel. I've criticized things in Israel very clearly. But I think there is one duty that derives from our responsibility for the Shoah. And this is the duty to really look closer at what is going on. We can't afford, and I'm coming back to the joke of the two journalists, we can't afford to be superficial here. It is our damn duty, forgive my French here, it's our damn duty to look closer at what is happening here.
Final question. You already mentioned Israel's right to exist, which has been largely taken for granted by most of the international community in the last decades. What's the future perspective? Is this right as secure as it seems, and how might it look in 50 years?
I think key to this question, it's again, I have to admit, the $1 million Canadian dollar question, and it's hard to answer this very difficult question. You know, when I was hiring a person in Israel, I asked the typical German question, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And actually, they were totally laughing at me because this question was totally unfamiliar in Israel. In Israel, people tend to think, well, I don't know where I am in 5 years. Maybe I'm not alive anymore. This is a totally different threat perception. So they would laugh if you would ask this question to an Israeli. They would laugh at you. Mm-hmm. But I'm taking it very serious. And I think one of the key factors is Iran. Mm-hmm. Iran is key because the one power which is currently playing with the fire is Iran. Hamas would have never gone to this war. They would never have committed this attack without the help of Iran. They would never had exerted this attack without the help of Hezbollah, which is a one-to-one proxy of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But if we have a closer look at the situation in Iran, we see there is a very young generation. What we have in Iran is a generational conflict. The young generation is very much oriented to the West. They are very well educated. And what is being done by Iran is mainly being done by the revolutionary elite,
yes.
By the old generation. And I think it can't go on forever like this in Iran. I'm pretty sure that there will be, hopefully not a civil war, but there will be at one time there will be a change in the situation in Iran. And if it will go to the better, we will also have a totally different situation. And there's another thing I would like to point out is if we compare this situation to situations we had 10 years ago, the Arab factor is very, very important. I'm absolutely sure that the breathtaking developments around the so-called Abraham Accords, the rapprochement between the Arab states and Israel, that this development is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's roughly three motivations for Saudi Arabia, for instance, to have closer contact to Israel. First is this the situation with Iran. Also, the Saudis regard Iran to be the most deadly threat. So there is the old idea of my enemy's enemy is my friend.
Mm-hmm.
But that's number one. Number two is, of course, these countries like Saudi Arabia see that they can't earn their money alone with oil anymore. So what they need is they need some ally, so to say, some partner they can deal with in economic terms, and that's Israel. But, of course, there is deep wisdom in the saying of Bill Clinton, it's the economy stupid, but I have to admit it's always the military stupid. What they really need is drones, is Israeli drones. Israel is a world leader in producing armed drones. The so-called Heron drone, also the German Bundeswehr is using these drones, is very important. And the Arabs, Saudi Arabia, they need these drones.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm absolutely sure that they will restart this rapprochement. And this creates a new situation. This is, of course, also some kind of a life insurance for Israel. And, you know, a lot of experts clearly say that one of the motivations behind the attack of Hamas against Israel was also the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Because Hamas sees that if there is a closer cooperation, it will also worsen the situation of the terrorists. So I think there can be maybe, as I said, maybe we will have a change to a much worse situation. But maybe we are now in the situation where things might change to the better. And a lot of my hopes are in these Abraham Accords, are in this rapprochement between the Arab states and Israel. Because this totally changes the situation. And if you ask me, will there be a peace solution? There might be one, but it is not Europe to be the decisive factor. It is maybe not even alone the US to be the decisive factor. It's a regional thing. It's the regional partners who then will be decisive. Mm. So maybe there is the little, very little seed of hope.
Dr. Michael Borchert, thank you for coming and best of luck for your new book here in Canada and in Germany.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for your interest in our latest episode of Canada mit Sem. If you would like to learn more about the work of the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung Canada and stay up to date on upcoming events, publications and more, please feel free to visit our homepage and subscribe to our quarterly newsletter at www.ks.de/Canada. Thank you very much and we look forward to welcoming you again in the next episode of Canada mit Sem.